Well, this is a hard issue to engage with, and I applaud and am grateful for the many people who've said, hey, can we talk about this issue? We haven't really addressed it as a congregation in many years, or since things took a really terrible and tragic turn starting last October. We have had contentious arguments about Israel, Palestine, the history and future of the Middle East in the past, here at UUCPA and in Unitarian Universalism at large. And we're nice folks. We want to get along. And if we fear conflict, then we tend to want to stay away. If we want everyone to get along, or at least seem to get along, we steer clear of the issues that have caused angry outbursts among friends in the past. If we didn't witness them, maybe we've heard about them. And if we haven't heard about them, then the hesitation that we see in others when we touch on an issue tells us, sore spot. Take a long way around it. Now, conflicts become particularly difficult to resolve or even to talk about when they involve questions of identity, who you are. So, Israeli Jews, Palestinian Muslims, Arab Christians, these are matters not just of opinion, which is hard enough, but of identity. They run really deep. They run to the core of who a person is in the world. And here, halfway around the world from that land of conflict, you can still feel very much that this is a matter of your identity. If, for example, you're Muslim, you're Jewish, you have roots or family in that part of the world. These are also issues, especially for the people right there, of survival, which of course makes them much more fraught. And there is a great deal of trauma, the trauma passed on through generations in stories and memories and pictures, passed on from grandparents who put their belongings on their backs and fled in the Nakba, the great catastrophe, from parents who escaped the Holocaust or left behind family who did not, from the stories of those who didn't escape. It's difficult to talk about these things, and it's necessary. The higher the stakes, the harder it is, the more important it is that we engage, that we not just wash our hands of it or turn away. For those of us who are not intimately connected by identity or familial trauma, whose survival or the survival of whose families is not on the line, it's difficult in a different way. It can feel like, well, who am I to speak about this? It can feel like we owe it to one side or another to take up their part. It can feel like we're ignorant and that we don't know what sources of information to trust. That's really hard. All of those things are real. An organization called Living Room Congregations aims to, this is a quote from their mission, connect people across divides and within communities to build understanding through conversation. And I learned of its existence recently from a person with whom I have spoken about Palestine and Israel painfully. Painfully because we both care deeply about it and about each other, and because we often disagree on the nature of the problem and what would be good solutions. But we're talking. When she learned that I was bringing this topic to our worship service, she first of all congratulated the congregation on your courage. And she pointed me to the guidelines of the Living Room Conversations. This, by the way, is a different group than one you might know, the Jewish-Palestinian Living Room Dialogues up on the peninsula. But it's not all that different. One of the principles of the Living Room Conversations is note any common ground. Note any common ground, as well as any differences. Differences tend to spring easily to mind when it comes to this issue. One place of common ground: we are all mortal. And being mortal, we all suffer pain and loss. Now, that might be another reason that we shy away from this topic, but I suggest that that might be a place to begin when we talk about it, to begin when we think about it, and return to this matter when the conversation turns contentious. Simply the acknowledgement of suffering. Can we let our souls be touched by the tears of the orphaned child of Kibbutz Be'eri? And the agony of the father carrying his dead infant in Jabalia camp? That in itself, just holding this, can be so hard to do, not only because it's just hard to hold pain and sit there with it and the reality of it, but also because we move quickly to defensiveness, anger, blame. So without weighing whose suffering we're hearing more about, or whom we consider more innocent and whom more responsible, or whose group has suffered more in the past month or year or century or millennium, these things matter. They are the differences that the Living Room Conversations urge us to note, but we also need to note our common ground. And what we have in common is that none of us wishes to suffer, and that we all do. Yehuda Amichai turns our attention to this universality in the poem we will now hear.
The Diameter of the Bomb by 20th century Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. The diameter of the bomb was 30 centimeters. With the diameter of its effective range around 7 meters, with 4 dead and 11 wounded. And around these, in a larger circle of pain and time, 2 hospitals are scattered and 1 graveyard. But the young woman who was buried in the city she came from, at a distance of more than 100 kilometers, enlarges the circle considerably. And the solitary man mourning her death at the distant shores of a country far across the sea, includes the entire world in the circle. And I won't even mention the crying of the orphans that reaches up to the throne of God and beyond, making a circle with no end and no God.
Another way that this conflict engages and requires all of us to respond is that both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia have spiked here in our country since this particular wave of the long conflict hit last fall, resulting in intimidation, fear, injury, and even murder. Both have spiked here, I say. Every time I utter the word both, I am aware of the dangers of both sides-ism, aware of the ripple that might be within us, around us, counting it up, saying, but it's happened more to so-and-so. but has caused death to this side. Speaking of one and then the other carries an implication that both sides are equal in power, which is never true in any conflict. For that matter, it implies that there are two sides, which is a vast oversimplification. And this is why even to speak about it is fraught with conflict. There is no way to speak about this topic without contested terms, terms such as Palestine, the occupied territories, settlers, genocide, even conflict. Even the names of towns, whether one uses the Arabic name for them or the Hebrew, may unwittingly put weight on one side of the debate or another. If we seek to learn the history, the date we begin with frames the debate in a way that cannot be free of bias. Did these events begin on October 7th, 2023? Way too simple. In 1967, with Israel's occupation of Gaza and the West Bank? No. In 1948, with the founding of the State of Israel and the first war in that new country? That's not where it started. With the communities who lived on that land in the 19th century, or in the 7th century before the Common Era, or in the centuries in the Bronze Age when it was called Canaan? No, there's no right answer. But you can see how the starting point can direct the conversation before it even begins. So what are we to do? Simply refuse to engage? This is not an option we can accept. Here's a different approach. To follow another of the living room conversation's principles and be curious and listen to understand. You know, listening to understanding, as opposed to listening to hear the weak parts in somebody's argument, or to hear the next thing that you're going to say. So hard when tempers run high and the issues run deep. But to listen, to be curious and listen to understand, not in order to judge, not to be ready to contest each statement or argue about each term or fight over each date that might either give or give up a strategic advantage, much the way that the warring sides battle over each acre of blood-soaked earth. We can commit ourselves to listen in order to understand, to learn something we don't know yet, which is how another feels and thinks. Something we don't know, no matter how many facts we know of the situation. In that spirit of openness and curiosity, I was delighted that Jesse said he would read these words from a Palestinian voice. But Jesse is running sound, so he's not going to be up here with his yarmulke on his head and his Jewish star around his neck. We have Geralyn Moran stepping in for Jesse instead.
The title of this is I Have a Seat in the Abandoned Theater by 20th century Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. I have a seat in the abandoned theater. It's in Beirut. I might forget, and I might recall, the final act without longing, not because of anything other than that the play was not written skillfully. Chaos. As in the war days of those in despair, and an autobiography of the spectator's impulse. The actors were tearing up their scripts and searching for the author among us, we, the witnesses, sitting in our seats. I tell my neighbor, the artist, don't draw your weapon and wait unless you're the author. No. Then he asks me, and you, Are you the author? No. So we sit scared. I say, be a neutral. Be a neutral hero to escape from an obvious fate. So he says, no hero dies revered in the second scene. I will wait for the rest. Maybe I would revise one of the acts, and maybe I would mend what the iron has done to my brothers. So I say, it is you then. He responds, you and I are two masked authors and two masked witnesses. I say, how is this my concern? I'm a spectator. And he says, no spectators at Chasm's door, and no one is neutral here, and you must choose your part in the end. So I say, I'm missing the beginning. What's the beginning?
No spectators at Chasm's door. We're not spectators. This war and the creation of a just and lasting peace in the Middle East is our concern. It is our concern both because of our distance from the issue and because of our involvement in it. Yep, sorry, I just said reliable coming and going. Let me explain. We have some distance in that for most of us, this is not a matter of identity and survival. Eventually, we got to get to the really hard stuff. The people who have lost family, the people who have wept in the rubble have to speak to each other. But it really helps them to do it if people a little farther out from the conflict have started to build that road. People closest to the conflict are very segregated from each other, even if they live just a couple of miles apart. But we have had the opportunity to build community in many, many ways. We care about each other. We hear about each other's sorrows and joys. We work together on projects. And so we have a close-knit community before we even learn about one another's stances on this position. That's a really good way to go into a contentious conversation. That distance can really help us make a difference in the dialogue. And we're involved. We can't just say, sorry, not my problem, not only because nothing human is foreign to us, but because as US Americans, we are very much participants in this conflict. The United States is one of the biggest players outside the Middle East, outside Israel and Palestine in the conflict. And so we're a part of it. There's also the fact that many US Americans observe that our country was founded on a philosophy of colonialism, even genocide, and they see echoes of that in Israel and Palestine. That's both true and illuminating and misleading. It can be very tempting to just import everything we understand and even try to expiate our own sins as a country by how we tell other countries how to handle things. So again, our distance and our involvement may lead us to understanding, they lead us to culpability and potential if we keep our ears open and we're listening to understand. Many who know something of the background of this conflict have lots of incidents and quotes at their fingertips, bitter moments, moral turning points that rise to the surface whenever the issue of Palestine and Israel arises. We can wrap these around ourselves as comfort or throw them at others as weapons. We can quote David Ben-Gurion, an early leader of modern Israel, laying out the whole plan of expansion and domination and say, see, that is what Zionism is and has always been about. Or we can quote him saying, we never want to expel or replace the Arabs who live in the land of Israel. Both of these are facts. Both are true. So are we going to use them to understand or simply fuel the conflict. We can quote Yasser Arafat, the peacemaker and compromiser, or Yasser Arafat, the implacable foe who will not rest until Israel is destroyed. Both are facts. We can cite the one we wish in order to bolster one side or another, and of course both are true also in searching down through Jewish texts and history, Muslim texts and history, all ways that we can drive the wedge deeper, or we can learn and listen and accept that all of the extreme statements, acts of violence, brave gestures of cooperation are all parts of a complex picture. They all make the road on which we can travel to peace, the road that's already beneath our feet, and that we continue to build out of our own actions and words from this point as we travel. Let's acknowledge that this conflict seems more entrenched than ever, more hopeless than it was a year ago, for sure, when it was already pretty grim. Some people might fantasize that it will end, or should end, or can only end with the utter destruction of one side or the other. But for us, people who practice compassion and seek justice, that is utterly unacceptable. The cycle of killing, loss, bitterness, vengeance can end in another way. It's a way that's very, very difficult. But unlike all the other possible endings, it is compatible with compassion and justice. And that way is, well, instead of saying it, I will leave it to someone more eloquent, the benevolent alien, known to science fiction as Doctor Who or simply the Doctor.
This reading is from The Zygon Inversion by British writer Peter Harness and Steve Moffat. It is an episode of the television series Doctor Who, and the speaker is the Doctor. So let me ask you a question about this brave new world of yours. When you have killed all the bad guys, and when it's all perfect and just and fair, when you have finally got it exactly the way you want it, what are you going to do with the people like you, the troublemakers? How are you going to protect your glorious revolution from the next one? Nobody wins for long. The wheel just keeps turning. So come on. Break the cycle. Every war ever fought is always the same. When you fire that first shot, no matter how right you feel, you have no idea who's going to die. You don't know whose children are going to scream and burn, how many hearts will be broken, how many lives shattered, how much blood will spill until everybody does what they were always going to have to do from the very beginning. Sit down and talk.
We're going to have to sit down and talk. That is the only road to peace. Everybody's going to have to sit down and talk. The ones who least want to do it are going to gather around that table sooner or later. And we, people connected by threads to the issue, sometimes threads of ethnicity or of religion, sometimes of family and place, and always threads of love and concern, we can help by talking ourselves, talking to each other, sticking with it when it gets difficult, because that's when it's getting real. That's when it's really working. Reverend Kat and I have made a commitment to each other and to the Action Council and to all of you. We will design processes for these conversations to happen at UUCPA with whatever format will help, whatever learning we might need. Maybe you know lots and lots about the issue, and the challenge for you is talking with others about it. Maybe you just don't know much about it and feel like you ought to. We will create ways for UUCPA to engage, and we are starting right now by asking you three questions. Got a slide here. If you're in the main hall, you have an index card. If you don't have that index card, you raise your hand because Eric and Harry have them for you. Index card or a little slip of paper about that size. If you're online, you have access to email. So will you take a moment now? Yeah, raise your hand if you are here and want a card. Please take a minute now and write or type to me at parishmin@uucpa.org. For my and Reverend Kat's eyes only, no one else will see this. The answers to three questions. What is a hope I have about Israel, Palestine? What is a fear I have about it? And what is something I want to learn about it? Now, it helps us if you include your name and contact information, because we might want to clarify what you mean or just clarify your handwriting, you know. But you can stay anonymous if you prefer, that's fine. The crucial thing is to find out some, for us to find out some hopes and fears and gaps in knowledge so that we can design the next stage. The one where we really start to talk together about the whole tangled business and listen to each other. So I'm going to give you that time to do that. And just fold it, hold on to it. If you're here in person, you'll be able to turn it in. Obviously, if you're emailing, just send it off to me. There's the address. You can keep writing while I keep talking. So the part where we start to talk about it and listen to each other, if you're feeling nervous right now, yeah, me too. It's kind of scary. If we weren't scared of it, we would have done it a lot more and a long time before now. We don't like conflict, but we do love peace. Eleanor Roosevelt said, we have to believe in peace in order to bring it about. I hope she didn't mean that we have to believe peace is possible, because that requires a faith that we might not always have. I hope she just meant that we have to believe peace is worth striving for, because it is so precious a dream. We have to love it. If we love it, we have to do more, she said. We have to work for it. So can we do that? For the sake of the children who have not yet died, who might yet live to adulthood and even thrive in a free land, if we do our part to help bring peace, we dislike conflict, but we love peace, and peace is not won through avoiding hard conversations. Peace is not about staying away from conflict. Peace isn't about dwelling in a quiet, lush glen where there is nothing to fear. It's more about striding up the mountain along the twisty trails that overlook chasms, going bravely into the places that scare us.
Courage, by 20th century U.S. American aviator and author Amelia Earhart. Courage is the price that life exacts for granting peace. The soul that knows it not knows no release from little things. Knows not the livid loneliness of fear, nor mountain heights where bitter joy can hear the sound of wings. How can life grant us boon of living, compensate for dull gray ugliness and pregnant hate, unless we dare the soul's dominion? Each time we make a choice, we pay with courage to behold the resistless day and count it fair.
We know this. Too much blood has already spilled. Too many children have already screamed and burned. Too many hearts have broken. Too many lives have shattered. And dear ones, if this feels overwhelming to you, as it often does to me, please take heart from this fact. We can make it more likely that the screaming, bleeding, and burning will stop and a free existence in a just land will begin. We have that power. And to exercise it, we don't even have to have the courage to join an army or deliver aid to a war zone. We only have to have the courage to practice two more principles in the living room conversations: show respect and suspend judgment, and be authentic and welcome authenticity from others. Respect instead of judgment, authenticity. They do take courage. No question. But we were made for such a challenge.